Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Daniel Brandenburg on the demonstration of Christ's leadership in secular models.
And then the role of the leader was not to be the one calling all the shots. It was to be like a gardener. That's the image that he uses. And what a gardener does is just till the soil and bring the water and create the conditions for the plants to flourish. And that's the role of a leader within the complexity of leadership. And so then I look at, okay, did Jesus face these type of situations? And certainly the world at the time of Jesus was not as complex as ours is today. But there certainly are indicators even there of parallels with the style of leadership of Jesus.
Daniel Brandenburg next. As you'll hear, Catholic scholar Dr. Daniel Brandenburg realized a major omission in his doctoral leadership studies, the person of Jesus. He believes Jesus has been ignored, forgotten, and excised from the company of modern leadership research. Hence, his new book, Leader Like No Other, What Secular Leadership Models Reveal About Jesus. Here's Spencer Dahlke.
What prompted the idea of Leader Like No Other? What put this idea in your head?
It's really fascinating because a few years back, I was in my doctoral studies in leadership at Creighton University. They have an interdisciplinary leadership program based out of Omaha, Nebraska. And I finished the 4 years of studies, and we looked at all kinds of leaders. We looked at, you know, military leaders and political leaders and civil rights leaders, all different types. And it was really fascinating. I loved the program. But I finished, graduated, and I was reflecting with some other people about like what I'd studied, and it dawned on me for the first time that not once in those 4 years of doctoral studies had we talked about Jesus Christ as a model of leadership. And I was like, wait a second. I mean, how is that possible? I mean, if you look at it just at a very superficial level, there is no one in the history of humanity who has had more followers than Jesus. So it's quantity of followers, no one even comes close. Then you look at the quality of those followers. I mean, you got men and women who are willing to lay down their life for Jesus, who abandoned home and went off to foreign countries, who gave up all kinds of things in order to follow Jesus. Then you look at the lasting nature of his message. You look at the fact that he's able to transcend provincial boundaries. I mean, on so many different levels, there's been no leader in the history of humanity like Jesus Christ. Leader like no other. And yet for 4 years, I had ignored him. I could blame the curriculum of the university, but I hadn't really been thinking about Christ as a great leader either. And so that brought up a second question, Spencer. I mean, what would happen if I looked at the top 10 leadership models developed in the secular world? These are not religious leadership models, but secular leadership models. And then look at the evidence for how Jesus stacks up against them. And that's what I do in the book. And boy, it was so fascinating. I've been following Jesus since I was a little kid. I grew up in a devout Catholic family. I entered the seminary. I became a missionary priest when I was, young man. And so I've been following Jesus my whole life. But when I did this study and this research, I discovered so many new things about the Lord that were so fascinating.
I understand you have degrees in philosophy and theology and education and all this sort of thing.
That's right.
How did that academic background shape your research process in
Great
understanding
question.
These models?
Well, I had to do all the work for, the studies in philosophy, which helps you to think how to seek out the truth. And then studies of theology is how do we understand faith and deepen that experience that we have of God's love and put that into terms that we can, transcend certain boundaries. So all of those studies were really, really helpful. Actually, when I did the doctoral studies in the field of education, I had, in a certain sense, a leg up on a lot of my fellow students because they'd come from, secular backgrounds, all different backgrounds coming into the cohort that we had. And it really facilitated a lot of deeper conversations with people. And in some ways, in academia today, there are a lot of biases that come in, oftentimes an anti-Christian bias. that when you have studies of philosophy, it helps you to transcend some of the pigeonholing that goes on in academia. So that those are really, really helpful when I came into the area of education. And fascinatingly enough, in the realm of leadership studies, they tend to come from a background of psychology and sociology and business. So those are three disciplines that are very much kind of hands-on, that don't really go into deeper questions of truth, of a metaphysical grounding of reality. And so I was able to draw in into an interdisciplinary program, something that most of my fellow students and even the professors were not used to, which was someone who was well-versed in philosophy and theology. And then, you know, obviously in the doctoral program, I had to do a lot of sociological, statistics, psychology, drawing that in. And, you know, did my dissertation, finished the doctorate. And this was a postdoctoral research and work. But I brought all those skills I had developed in those three other disciplines into this fresh study of Christ.
I guess for the sake of defining terms, would you compare and contrast for us how you understand leadership and how our culture, secular culture, understands leadership?
I think the generic understanding that we have kind of in our culture is that, I put this in a presentation and actually part of my book, is seven myths about leadership. And different people have different myths. We may not have all of them. We might have one of them or two of them or seven of them. But I've identified and talked with people over the years and identified seven of these myths. One of them is that leadership is about position. And I think this is a primary fallacy that a lot of people have, that, you know, if you have a title, then you're a leader. And we even confuse our language sometimes. But leadership isn't about titles. We've all had people who were our boss, but they were a bad boss. They're not a good leader. Okay, the title does not make the person. Sometimes there's a supposition as well, another myth, that, you know, you're born a leader or you're born a loser. I mean, to put it in crass terms, or in a nicer terms, you could say either you're born to be a leader or you're born to be a follower. And that's also false, because the reality is, Spencer, that each one of us, we kind of go in and out of roles. I mean, look at the greatest leaders that we have in the world today. You know, take a president of the United States or of any other country. Take the Pope. You know, take any religious leader. Take a leader in business. I guarantee you that they actually spend more time following than leading. They have to follow the direction of their secretary. Their secretary fills their schedule and tells them what to do. They follow the direction of their spouse in many circumstances. They follow the direction of, you know, so many other things that are around us in society. So even people that we would think of as, oh, they're a leader, they're actually more of a follower than they are a leader. And there's different circumstances where a person can rise to a leadership position or role, and other times when they fall back into their following the crowd. I mean, you think of a businessman who, you know, he's calling the shots in the business place all day long, and then he comes home and he does what his wife tells him to do. He says, honey, you know, wash the dishes. And he washes the dishes if he wants to keep his marriage intact. So there's all kinds of these myths. And another myth I think is very pernicious is the myth of self-doubt, of the imposter syndrome. People who think, well, I'm not a leader. Well, I firmly believe everyone has the capacity to be a leader in some realm, because every single one of us has received gifts from God, and we can use those gifts for good or for evil, or we can just set them aside and be like the useless servant in the gospel, the parable of the talents, who, you know, dug a hole and stuck his talents into them, and then is punished by his Lord when he comes back. All of us have the potential to be a leader. The question is, do we leverage that? Do we utilize the gifts and talents God has given us in those specific realms where we can make a difference?
I thought it was interesting that you mentioned, leaders find themselves following, because you have to...
That's right. And even our Lord followed. He followed his Father. You know, we see so many passages in Scripture where he talks about, his Father and doing his Father's will, and the Father and I are one. And we see Jesus struggling with his father's will in the Garden of Gethsemane. We see Jesus following his mother. You know, when he works his very first miracle at the wedding feast of Cana, why does he work the miracle? Just look at scripture, and it's clear that he does it at the instigation of his mother. He's following her lead. So it's really fascinating when you look at leadership from that perspective, that it's not a binary category of you're either a leader or a follower. Is that all of us are human, and at certain times we'll lead and certain times we'll follow.
Just playing the devil's advocate a little bit. You mentioned one of these myths of not having a title. Leadership does not come from titles. And yet, I mean, even God the Father anointed Jesus the Son, saying, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him."
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that?
Right. Clearly, there's a role for designation of authority that strengthens a person's leadership position. If you look at it in this way, and I actually have a graph that breaks this down in the book of four sources of authority. Authority can come from position, so someone designates authority, but that's actually the weakest form of authority. Then authority can come from moral authority, where you have a person who is either very competent in what they do or their character is such that we implicitly trust them. That elicits from us an authority which can be independent of a designation from any other place. Then we have what we would call creative authority. So for example, when God creates us, he naturally acquires an authority over us because we are his creatures. And in the same way, if I write a book, or if I write a song, I have author's copyrights over those things because I'm the creator. So at these different levels, we can see how authority is bestowed upon a person. And the designation of authority is very real. It strengthens leadership, but it also tends to be the weakest of those forms.
I guess for the sake of looking at some of these models, I mean, the meat of your book is looking at how we have modeled leadership in secular culture and applying
that
to Jesus.
10 different leadership models.
Mm-hmm. Right. Could you maybe point out one or two just to start that you thought were the most interesting?
There were several that I picked all 10 of the models because it was arbitrary. There's hundreds of models out there of leadership, but I tried to pick ones that were more prominent and emblematic of the growth of leadership studies over the years. So two of them that were particularly fascinating for me were complexity leadership, which is the last model of leadership that I address, and also leadership behaviors. And I chose a specific model for the leadership behaviors. There's multiple different models that all kind of bring different pieces of the pie, if you will. One that I looked at in particular is a book by Sam Walker called The Captain Class, which is a really fascinating premise. He is the head of the Wall Street Journal's sports section. And if you've ever read the Wall Street Journal, you know there's a lot of data and statistics, and that's how he approaches sports. So he had a fascinating idea a number of years ago to figure out which were the most dominant teams in the history of team sports across all different countries and different sports. So like crew and soccer, baseball, volleyball, all different sports. And he put a series of criteria. A team had to be dominant for a certain number of years, had to win every major title, etc. And there were only, I think if I remember correctly, there were 19 teams that met the cut from like a 100-year period. And so you had, for example, the All Blacks, who are a rugby team down in New Zealand. You had the soccer team from Hungary from 1950 to 1953. And the New York Yankees dominating in baseball in two different time periods. So once he had identified these teams, he looked to see what were the common characteristics of all the teams. And what he found is that the dominant teams was not because they had a bigger budget, was not because of their coach or their owner, wasn't the manager, it wasn't even the star player. It was actually the captain of the team. And the captain usually was not the most talented player, but they had a force of will that they brought to their team that pulled them together. And the dominance of the team began with when that captain started and ended when they left the team in each case. And then Sam Walker looked at, okay, what were the traits or the behaviors of these captains? And he found 8 common traits that were across all of these captains. And it was, I mean, super fascinating. Things like a very democratic, down-to-earth communication style, a willingness to do the hard work that no one else wanted to do and work in the shadows, a willingness to challenge authority. And so you looked at all these different characteristics, and I was looking at this list, and I was like, I don't know if that's going to match up with Jesus. So I started looking at the evidence in Scripture, and one after another, I was surprised. Like, there were these episodes, these encounters that Jesus had, words that he said, in which he did exemplify the behaviors of these successful captains. And so, again, it like helped me to appreciate Jesus Christ at a whole nother level. Super fascinating. And then the other leadership model that I mentioned, complexity leadership, this is an area of a lot of modern research, because our world has gotten more complex. The rate of change is accelerated with the introduction of new technologies and AI and transportation. And our world has become more complex than in the past, and leaders have to adapt to that. One of the best books that I read on this particular model is called Team of Teams by General Stanley McChrystal. And he talks about how when he was appointed to be in charge of all the U.S. forces in Iraq for the counterinsurgency, he came into a situation in which the U.S. troops, best trained in the world, most resources, best intelligence, all of the training that they needed, and they were losing to a ragtag group of Iraqi insurgents. And why? Because of the structure of the leadership organization. And he realized what they had to change in the American forces was the way that they structured themselves. So it's some really fascinating lessons on leadership and adaptability to change. And they had to shift the typical top-down hierarchical structure of the military into a team of teams approach, in which they shared a common purpose, shared consciousness of sharing all the information that they had, built trust among each other. And then the role of the leader was not to be the one calling all the shots. It was to be like a gardener. That's the image that he uses. And what a gardener does is just till the soil and bring the water and create the conditions for the plants to flourish. And that's the role of a leader within the complexity of leadership. And so then I look at, okay, did Jesus face these type of situations? And certainly the world at the time of Jesus was not as complex as ours is today. But there certainly are indicators even there of parallels with the style of leadership of Jesus.
That's so interesting that the first model you were talking about in your answer there, you're talking about democratic communication and how it relates to like team captains. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I thought you were talking about complexity leadership then. Would you remind me what term you used to name that one?
It's a form of behavioral, what are the behaviors that lead to good outcomes in leadership? And so there's lots of different models that plug into a behavioral approach to leadership. So that's what I was referring to in that first section. And there's some other books that, you know, you've got, for example, Kuznets and Posner and, the different forms of leadership there. You have transformational leadership that comes a little bit into the behavioral model, but transcends it. So that's the first one I was talking about. The second one is the complexity leadership. And again, within complexity leadership, there's all kinds of books out there. I hinted at just one, Team of Teams from General Stanley McChrystal. There's another great one by L. David Marquette, which is an example from the U.S. Navy. And his book is called Turn the Ship Around. Another really fascinating story where he came into becoming the captain of a submarine, which was the worst performing in the Pacific Fleet. And in 6 months, it became the top performing submarine in the Pacific Fleet. And he details how he achieved that change. And it was just by some very simple things, but it was removing the top-down approach to leadership and creating an empowered type of leadership where every person, every one of his subordinate officers, instead of coming to him for the decisions, he taught them how to make decisions and to inform him, but to make the decisions. So, and it was just a simple change in language. He told all of his officers, don't come to me with problems, come to me with what you intend to do. And so they would have to come to him and say, sir, I intend to. And that simple change transformed that submarine in 6 months.
That's fantastic. That's so interesting. So for these two models, I mean, obviously the subtitle of your book is What These Models Reveal About Jesus.
That's right.
What do these models reveal to you about Jesus? And were these surprising?
Well, I think the most surprising thing is that Jesus exemplifies all the best traits and behaviors and understanding of the great leaders of our world today with models that didn't exist at his time. It's not like Jesus was trying to measure up to these models when he was living here on earth. But in a sense, I mean, he's the creator of these models because he is Lord of time and history. And so that was, for me, was a tremendous discovery and a deepening of my appreciation for leadership. Because sometimes as moderns, we think we're so sophisticated and intelligent, like we've got it all figured out. And, you know, all these antiquated people back 2,000 years, a bunch of morons who knew nothing. and that's simply not the case. True wisdom lasts through all the ages. And Jesus, we know, is the source of all wisdom. And so discovering that in this field, which has always fascinated me, the field of leadership studies, to discover that Jesus truly is leader like no other was a fascinating and encouraging discovery for me.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as if Jesus was the Son of God, obviously, but also the ideal and representative man.
That's right. And then the quintessential leader. And right. I try to share that excitement with people as I go through the book, kind of that journey of discovery that we're all on throughout our life. And, you know, one of the things too, Spencer, I've read a lot of leadership books over the years, and I find that you can find a nugget or two in pretty much every book that you read. Some are more, more full of nuggets than others, real gold mines, if you will. And what I try to do is draw together a lot of those great insights. But then also, you know, you can read a thing and then forget it. And when you do reflection, you know, personal reflection, and then exercises around something, it helps you to interiorize it more. So at the end of every chapter, I have questions for reflection and then some leadership exercises you can do that are tied to that specific model and to how Jesus exemplified that, that can help you to interiorize it in your own life. And so it can be used for personal use, or if, you know, a group of people wanted to use it as like a book study. So it's very helpful for that. And then a third possible usage is it's actually written to be a complementary textbook. So if someone's, for example, teaching a class at university or high school level on leadership, this is a great text to utilize with students for fostering that discussion, that leadership development in students.
Part of the reason why I thought it was so interesting that one expert you mentioned described a good leader as a gardener is because I've heard it said that men, the call that God gives to men is to be gardeners of the people in their lives, which I guess goes back to the whole complementary and egalitarian debate. I know that's kind of controversial. You may or may not agree with one side or the other, but I will say for myself, I kind of lean more into the complementarian camp. It does seem like God maybe has unique calls for men and unique calls for women. Do you agree?
Without a doubt. I think we see that written into our psychology and into our very nature. There's a beautiful complementarity between men and women. And we know from the Genesis account that God made us in his own image, male and female, he created them, which does not imply a dominance of one over the other, but a mutual subjugation, a mutual complementarity. And I think that's forgotten sometimes in our world today because we want everything to be egalitarian. Like we do the same things. We can all do the same things. Men, you know, women can do the same things men do. well, we're not made to do the same things. And like, I'm a Catholic priest, a missionary priest, and you know, I've taught kids in school for many years. And I always get the question from girls teaching classes, like, why can't women be priests? And my response is, well, I'll answer your question if you answer mine. And like, well, they're kind of, you know, taking a little back, a little bit of back, and they say, okay, what's your question? And I say, well, why can't men be mothers? And they laugh a little bit and like, well, because you're missing something. It's like, yes, God made us different. And that's not bad. It's good. There's a complementarity. And so there are going to be many things that women do better than men. And there's going to be things that men do better than women. And it's not sexist to recognize that. It's kind of silly not to recognize it, to just put on blinders to reality in the name of some egalitarianism. It's silly. So I think that recognizing this beautiful complementarity of men and women is absolutely necessary. And in the context of the book, Leader Like No Other, we can see how women actually carry out certain behaviors more naturally in leadership than men do. For example, in the realm of transformational leadership, which is, you know, the recognition of the dignity of a person, attentiveness to the needs of people, women do better at carrying out transformational leadership than men do in general. Now, again, we're talking on a statistical level and generalities. There will be specific women that don't do it as well or a specific men that do it better. But in general, women do transformational leadership better than men. And it's one of the most important forms and best tested forms of leadership. So all to say, you know, that Christ gives us insight into this leadership and can help. Whether you're a man or a woman, God is going to help you if you're looking at him to become a better leader.
Yeah. I mean, you did. One of the questions I wanted to ask actually is, as complementarians, mm-hmm. What does leadership look like for the lay person, for men and for women? You did kind of answer my question a little bit there, but I'm curious if you could kind of explain more about what that might look like for the two.
It's very difficult to lay down hard and fast rules here, Spencer, because leadership is always within a specific context. And so depending on the people who are following, you know, their level of maturity, their age, what their cultural expectations are, leadership has to shift in order to be effective. One of the really fascinating books that we had to read was The New Psychology of Leadership. And the authors of that book lay out four rules for effective leadership. The first is you have to be considered one of us in order to be an effective leader. That means you'll be effective as a leader with this subset of people. You know, if you're in Nevada, you've got to be attentive to the cultural needs of this place. So you have to adapt. And this is a whole model of leadership called situational or adaptive leadership, which recognizes the vagaries and the shifting circumstances of time and place that a leader has to be attentive to in order to be effective as a leader. So all that has to be taken into consideration.
Well, let me put one last question to you, which I thought was interesting. If you could add an 11th leadership paradigm to a hypothetical future edition of your book, what emerging model from today's world, given, you know, the changes in AI and how this might affect our culture, mm-hmm. what would you add and how would you compare it to Jesus and why?
You know, I think what I would add actually is a model of followership. So throwing a little bit of a monkey wrench, because we talk so much about leadership, but there's actually a really burgeoning area of followership studies and the importance of being a good follower. How do you be a not just a passive sheep that's going along to get along, but how do you become an active follower who's contributing to the good of the organization? And there's some fascinating research that's being done on those dimensions of followership. In some respects, it's not as flashy as leadership to talk about followership, but it's critically important for organizations and for ourselves. As we said from the very beginning, Spencer, we spend more time in our lives as followers than leaders. So it's good to learn to be a good follower. And in fact, I think as Christians, we can't be a good leader unless we are first a good follower. So this pattern is, I think this model will be fascinating to discuss, to dig into more deeply. And I hope that each one of your listeners can take away something useful for this. And, you know, our pilgrimage throughout this world, you're the Pilgrim Radio. It's great to have a leader like no other, like our Lord Jesus Christ, who helps us on our pilgrim way.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Dr. Daniel Brandenburg, author of Leader Like No Other, What Secular Leadership Models Reveal About Jesus. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us again on Monday at the same time for another edition of His People.